Thank you, Your Honor. And for the record, Robert Borquez, registration number 19577, appearing on behalf of defendant appellant Kevin Herrera, who appeals the denial of his motion for post-conviction relief under Rule 35C. And I'd like to try to reserve 5 minutes if possible. I understand it may or may not work out that way. But I want to start off by focusing today on the claim of ineffective assistance on the part of appellate counsel in failing to pursue the denial of Mr. Herrera's post-trial motion raising the Crawford challenges to various hearsay statements. Time permitting, I may try to fit in another issue, but I want to focus on that one first of all. And the fact that I don't address any of the other issues shouldn't be considered an abandonment of any of those claims. We rely on in the briefs. In order to establish ineffective assistance on the part of counsel on a perfected direct appeal, appellate counsel, or the defendant, has to show that appellate counsel ignored issues which were clearly stronger than those issues pursued, and that had appellate counsel pursued the other issues, one or more of them would have been successful. In this case, appellate counsel pursued one single issue. It was an evidentiary ruling. It had to do with the co-conspirator hearsay issue. It was subject to review for abuse of discretion, and because the issue wasn't properly preserved, it was subject to plain error review. Unpreserved evidentiary rulings are rarely successful under plain error review. The language this court has used explains why plain error is rarely successful. It's been characterized as strong medicine, offering relief only on rare occasions. And in this case, it wasn't one of those occasions. Even Mr. Herrera's appellate counsel at his Rule 35C hearing conceded. He said, you never want to argue abuse of discretion on an appeal if you can help it.
Yeah, that's exactly. Are you suggesting that any time counsel on appeal picks an issue that's reviewed for plain error, as opposed to one where he might argue harmless error, that is by definition ineffective assistance?
It's not per se, Your Honor, no. I think you have to look at the entirety of the record, and then you have to make an assessment whether this issue, even though it was unpreserved, was such a strong issue that you're going to take the gamble and pursue it anyway, and forego other issues that are better preserved. I'm not saying that there's a per se rule.
You still have to show or convince us that one of the other issues, I guess the Crawford issue, was a better issue than the 404, the conspiracy 404B issue, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's the position we are taking, that at least the Crawford issue was stronger.
Okay.
Right. And regarding the Crawford claim, it came up in actually a post-trial motion. I guess I should just briefly touch on that. Mr. Herrera's trial was in the fall of 2003. He was sentenced in February 2004. And Crawford came down from the Supreme Court in March of 2004. There were a number of post-trial issues that were raised while his direct appeal had been filed.
It was after conviction, but before sentencing.
It was a month after sentencing.
After sentencing.
Was when Crawford came down. But there was a motion filed in the fall of 2004 raising the Crawford issues, and a different division of this court remanded, I think it was on November 30th, 2004, to the district court to resolve that issue. So that's how it was actually raised and litigated and preserved. And then it was recertified back here sometime in 2005. There were a number of Crawford statements, and the one I really want to focus on, because I think it's the most clear cut, is the statement from the surviving victim, Roberto McLean. I believe he was the passenger in the Mitsubishi truck, and he was interviewed by a police officer. I believe it was Officer Dale Lucky, and it's our position that this is clearly a testimonial. When a police officer is interviewing a material witness at a crime scene, it's for purposes of obtaining information that's going to be used in the investigation and prosecution of the crime.
Was this interview immediately at the crime scene or sometime later?
I'm not sure how soon or how. I think it may have been immediately, or it may have been at the hospital. But it was either immediately or shortly thereafter.
And they still had not identified who the perpetrators were yet.
Correct.
So it could have been for investigative purposes, not for testimonial purposes.
Well, I think when you're asking the surviving victim in a shooting, and there's a homicide, there's an idea that we're going to get information here. Investigation flows into prosecution.
Did the trial court make a ruling that these were investigatory as opposed to testimonial?
You know, my recollection, Your Honor, is that the trial court, the post-conviction court, or the, I guess they're both post-conviction proceedings, the remand hearing or the 35C hearing.
Right.
My recollection, the 35C hearing, the trial court's ruling was not very extensive and didn't go into that detail.
Mr. Borges, I have a question about the remedy. In the opening brief, you've asked that we remand this matter for a new hearing, which I'm not sure what the point of a new hearing would be.
And after, when I was preparing for this, Your Honor, it probably isn't for a new hearing if you reverse on this issue. I think that there would have to be a new trial.
Okay, so what we would do is review the issue in the same manner that it would be reviewed if he had had a direct appeal.
Yes, sir.
And so under that type of review, are we free to address the merits and or apply a harmless error analysis?
Yes, Your Honor, I was just going to get to the harmless error point, so you kind of beat me there. But
is it harmless or harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, and that's part of what I was going to get into, Your Honor. Because we're talking about a Crawford claim and its constitutional magnitude, it would have to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The post-conviction court did state that the statement from McLean was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because there was other evidence identifying the RAV4 and the three passengers. That other evidence, Your Honor, was the co-defendant, Adrian Santos, who testified at trial and said he was in the RAV4 and there were three passengers. And in fact, he's the one who got the vehicle from from one of his girlfriends. It's our position, Your Honors, that is not sufficient to establish harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt, because Mr. Santos, and it's in the record, he suffered from a long history of drug abuse. He was a co-defendant in this case, who was the beneficiary of a rather generous plea agreement. And in fact, I believe there may have been, in the plea agreement, he had the right to petition under Rule 35B for a further sentence reduction after my client's trial. So it's our position that while Mr. Santos certainly could testify, this is insufficient to establish harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt.
What did Santos say that was inculpatory?
Well, Santos said a number of things, Your Honor, but on this particular issue,
That McLean also testified about it. Oh, what?
McLean told the police.
The statements attributed to McLean.
Yeah, he identified the vehicle that pulled up, the number of occupants in the vehicle.
McLean did. And Santos did as well.
Yes.
So I was in the vehicle.
Yes.
To other people.
Yes, but it's our position that given his credibility issues, that this could not be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Were there other witnesses who corroborated?
I believe those were it, because the only other, there were allegedly three occupants in the vehicle, my client, Mr. Santos, and Mr. Turner. Derek Turner, who was the other co-defendant who went to trial, did not testify at my client's trial. The only other people would have been the deceased and Mr. McLean, so there were five potential people there.
Did McLean identify the defendant as one of the three people?
Not specifically, no.
But Santos did?
Yes. Okay, appellate counsel testified, I believe, at the 35C hearing that it was his understanding he only raised the one issue, and when he was asked about the Crawford claims, he said that it was his understanding that Crawford did not apply retroactively to this case. That was clearly incorrect, and I think that establishes the deficient representation component under Strickland as far as quality of his representation. Because this case was on direct appeal, Crawford did apply. And in fact, the fact that there was a remand to hear the Crawford motion should have been some indication that the direct appeal would have been the appropriate time to bring this up. If there are no other questions, I've got about 5 minutes left, and I like to reserve that for my rebuttal.
I just want to clarify.
Certainly.
The issue regarding the alleged misrepresentations to the grand jury by the prosecutor is not a component of ineffective assistance of counsel. It's a separate argument that you're making for a reversal.
That's correct, Your Honor. Maybe I could spend a moment just talking about that issue.
I just want to clarify that that's not part of ineffective assistance.
That's correct.
It's a standalone article.
That's correct.
Why wasn't that raised on direct appeal then? Or why should we hear it since it wasn't raised on direct appeal?
Well, there were a number of things that weren't raised on direct appeal, but I think that there was a question whether there was an adequate record made to bring it up on direct appeal. There was more fleshed out in the 35C hearing on that issue. And let me explain why. The grand jury took place in 1999, I believe. And the particular statement that its opposition was a misrepresentation by the prosecutor was made, I believe it was in September of 1999, during the colloquy with the grand jury, where he said that the shell casing found in Ms. Murray's RAV4 matched the gun. The gun was never compared to that shell casing until 2002, when the client was taken into custody. So that was a misstatement. My client learns about this, I believe it was in preparation for his trial, so it was never raised. Ideally, it should have been raised by a pretrial motion challenging the basis for the indictment. And there was a review hearing for probable cause, but I don't recall that being fleshed out in that proceeding.
But still, it could have been raised. It wasn't raised on direct appeal. You're not saying it's part of the ineffective assistance of counsel component, so it seems to me it would be barred as what we call successive.
Well, I'm working with the record that I got from the 35C hearing.
Okay. I just want to clarify, it's not part of the IAC, the ineffective assistance.
It's not, and I think that's, in fact, the way the brief was packaged. If there are no other questions, I'd like to save my last 3 minutes.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jay Fisher. I represent the people on this matter. My registration number is 44350. The defendant's counsel has correctly identified the standard he asked to meet to show ineffectiveness of appellate counsel. And as we understand, he's proceeding on the one issue regarding the alleged Crawford violations. Independent of any error analysis, which he has to show under Strickland, there's just no way that the defendant can show prejudice, the necessary prejudice to prevail on this particular claim. Regarding the testimony of Mr. McClain, and his position was that he was one of the victims in this particular matter. He was a passenger in the vehicle that was traveling down the road when the RAV4 pulled up next to it and the shots were fired into it. The driver of that particular vehicle was killed, and he was shot in the hand.
Mr. Fisher, before you get too much into the merits of that issue,
yes.
I want to ask you a more general question about the prejudice standard of review.
Yes.
As stated, I think Mr. Borges correctly said that one or more issue would have been successful. And so I'm asking you to clarify a little bit what that means. For example, if there's a split of authority, since we sit as a divisional court, what would we say about whether it would or would not have been successful?
I think it's somewhat unclear about what the particular burden he has to meet on that. I mean, if you're looking at it from the perspective that he has, that the issues were clearly stronger, and I think that's part you have to look at when you're analyzing this part, the particular concerns that Your Honor is expressing would, in fact, weigh in that particular analysis. If there's a split of authority, in other words, some divisions would, in fact, say it would prevail and some wouldn't.
Exactly.
Then, in fact, it's not clearly stronger. So based upon that, I would say that, in fact, that as an issue, it would be inferior. And counsel's or appellate counsel's analysis to say that I didn't raise it because I didn't think it would clearly prevail, would in fact be the assessment this court should adopt and say that in fact it wasn't a superior issue.
So is your position such that the error would have to be so blatant that any division on this court would reverse it before they can meet the prejudice standard?
Yes, that would be my position. Now, regarding Mr. McLean's testimony specifically, if this court looks at the record in particular, all the information that came from him was admitted by the testimony of other witnesses. And in fact, most of that information appeared in the record before any of the McLean information appeared before the jury. As well, if you look at the actual substance of McLean as an individual in this case, you see a person who's, at least his associate, if not his friend, has been shot and killed. He's in the hospital talking to police, and then all of a sudden, he essentially takes the fifth, and he stops talking to the officers. So I think another issue that has to be considered here is what is his position in the minds of a reasonable juror hearing this testimony? And how are they going to weigh and assess this particular individual when looking at the evidence in this case? And they're not essentially going to view him very positively in this particular matter.
Let's hold on for just a second. Can you stop the timer?
Sorry about that.
Okay. That's a first.
It's never happened to me before.
All right, go ahead. Thank you.
And essentially, when you're weighing him as an individual, this goes to whether his testimony is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Because you're assessing this person, you're trying to say, what is his impression going to be on the jurors if, in fact, we find that his testimony was hearsay, and say if he's viewed it negatively by the jurors, then it's harmless.
I want you to answer it this time.
And if your honors have any further questions regarding the Derek Turner issue, I can certainly go and address the alleged due process violation that was raised by Judge Richmond, if you so care. But in that particular issue, I think Judge Richmond has correctly identified that this issue may be waived. At least the people addressed it on the merits, because in fact it was addressed by the merits by the 35C court. So we were contemplating whether in fact we needed to address it on the merits to support the lower court decision. Obviously, we didn't raise the particular bar that Judge Richmond has identified in this particular matter. We wouldn't waive it, but at the same time, even if you look at the merits of that particular issue, the defendant wouldn't prevail as well for the reasons we cited in our brief, which is he just can't show prejudice in that particular matter. There were very extensive grand jury proceedings. It took up 11 transcripts, there were 25 witnesses. The defendant has cited to a single instance where he talks about the word matches that was raised up in an argument. There was far stronger evidence that was presented to the grand jurors before the indictment issued. And then, of course, there's the fact that he had a probable cause hearing, as well as a full trial on the indictment that was issued by the grand jury itself, and the statement of its burdens in both those proceedings. So there's no prejudice in that particular issue. And if there are no further questions, then we'd ask that you affirm the decision of the lower court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Borges, you have 3 minutes and 4 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor, and just have a couple of points I wanted to bring up. Regarding Judge Boras's question about whether we would have to show that there was, if not unanimity, at least there's no conflict between divisions in order to establish a standard as far as ineffective assistance by appellate counsel, I think that would have to be determined on a case-by-case basis. If we've got a situation where multiple divisions have come down one way, and maybe one isolated division has come down a different way, I think you have to look at the weight of the decisional case law that's published. So I'm not sure that that's a simple, clear-cut answer to that. The other thing I wanted to mention was regarding the question about whether the prosecutorial misconduct grand jury stage is barred here, Rule 35C. And I think even the people acknowledged that the issue was raised in the 35C motion. The bar was not raised by the post-conviction prosecutor down in El Paso County, and the judge did delve into the facts on that and did address it in her order. So I think to the extent that the people could have raised the bar, They didn't, and I would ask that the court consider that on the merits and reach a decision there. If there are no questions, we would ask that the court reverse the denial of the 35C motion and remand this matter for a new trial. Thank you.
Great, thank you both for your fine arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.